So that was a really key moment in this campaign. You know, and this is the late 1970s, as we know, you know, like this then led to an era in where a lot of the welfare programs were actually cut. So in some ways, those kind of concrete demands were not met. You know, they didn't have success with meeting these demands. But the movement really continued on to the 1980s to really expand their vision. Some people left the campaign in the late 1970s. The New York Wages Housework Committee, you know, dissolved. In Italy, the campaign came to a close in 1979. But Wilmette Brown, Margaret Prescott, and Selma James continued to organize throughout the 1980s, in particular to kind of project their image and their vision onto a global stage. Part of this, you know, played out in the halls of the UN, particularly in the UN conferences on women. So in 1985, for example, the UN Conference on Women that's held in Nairobi, Wages for Housework, led by Margaret Prescott, organized a delegation that would go there and, you know, argue at this kind of big forum that was, you know, talking about feminism on a global stage. You know, they argued that, you know, we know that women do the vast majority of the world's work and yet hold a fraction of the world's wealth. How do we account for that as feminists? How do we account as that as economists? So what they called for, in a way of kind of scaling up this earlier demand of Prescott, was that, you know, they had a kind of platform that they pushed to get passed to this conference, which would call on national governments around the world to develop accounting mechanisms to count the value of women's unpaid work and to make that part of how they evaluate economies. So that was one of the places where they really kind of tried to make this demand into a global rethinking of the economy. Another direction the Wages for Housework campaign took in the 1980s is in environmentalism. So in the 1980s, you have, you know, a lot of activism around nuclear proliferation. And one of the people who really became a spokesperson for linking, you know, the nuclear threat with this issue of unpaid women's work is Wilmette Brown. And this kind of started from, you know, the 1980s when Wilmette Brown was diagnosed with cancer. And in the process of healing from cancer, you know, she had two really important kind of insights. One was how much work it is to have cancer, right? You know, all the kinds of care work it requires to heal from cancer, the way the community steps in to care for somebody who is ill. And the second thing she realized is that cancer is not a burden that's distributed equally across society. One of the things that kind of came out in the 80s while she was in the process of recovering from cancer was a study that showed that the place where she grew up in Newark, New Jersey, had the highest cancer rates in the entire country. And that had to do with a lot of the kind of petrochemical plants that were along the Passaic River near where she lived. And it affected predominantly Black neighborhoods like hers. So she started thinking about the connections between environmental toxicity, racism, and women's unpaid work. And so she went on to be elected to the board of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And the big kind of push that she made was to recognize the ways that environmental racism and the disproportionate burdens of Black communities are connected to the broader fight for peace and for environmental justice. So Wilmette Brown had this really kind of big push. She ended up leaving the campaign in the 1990s, and you know, Margaret Prescott and Selma James continued on, and they continue working on this campaign to the present day. Many other groups have joined the organization. They've renamed the Wages for Housework campaign Global Women's Strike, and their work really gained particular momentum during the COVID-19 pandemic when care work became so visible to all of us in our lives. You know, it was the focus on essential work really kind of came to the fore. And so in the context of that, they renamed their demand from Wages for Housework to a more capacious kind of phrase. They call for care income now, you know, basically calling for compensation and support for anyone who does work of caring for people or the planet. So that kind of takes the campaign up to the present day. In conclusion, I want to just talk about some of the things that I've learned in the process of researching this history and writing this book. And I want to focus on three provocations that they made that I find really useful to understand in the contemporary world. The first provocation is this: the home is a workplace. We think about it, you know, typically as a kind of respite from the world of work, as a kind of, you know, a kind of safe haven from the world of market relations. But Wages for Housework really show that it's an essential part of it. And I think this really matters not just for those of us who care for children and do housework, you know, in our own lives, but to whole groups of workers who do this actually for their profession, you know, whose workplace is somebody else's home. And particularly, I want to talk about how Wages for Housework, you know, many of the activists from that campaign went on to work alongside domestic workers who are fighting for recognition of the work they do in the home. Historically, domestic workers, house cleaners, home health aides have not been recognized under labor law, again, because of this idea that the home is not a workplace. And so a lot of their efforts, you know, kind of culminated in 2011. The International Labor Organization passed Convention 189, otherwise known as Decent Work for Domestics, recognizing the home as a workplace and extending worker protections to all who work in the home. Now, a lot of places have yet to actually adopt this convention, but it's a really important step, I think, in actually dissolving that boundary that we set between the home and the workplace.